Did you know that slowing aging by a couple of percent would save more money than eradicating cancer? There are many reasons to be passionate about aging research, but this is perhaps the major one. To get out this message, we decided to start a podcast at VitaDAO. I'm Camille, also known as the Aging Scientist on Twitter, and I will be hosting this podcast. Today, I had the pleasure of talking to Rich Miller. He is a principal investigator at the University of Michigan, where his lab studies long-lived mice and tries to understand why mice and other animals live as long as they do. He has been instrumental in facilitating the birth of the interventions testing program, which was basically the program that first discovered that rapamycin works in mice. Rapamycin is right now the best anti-aging intervention we have that is reasonably close to human application. If you want to know one cool fact about Rich, I once checked, and it appears that he has co-authored more mouse longevity studies than a small European country, like for example the Netherlands. I guess that makes him quite experienced in the field. Given this, it should not be surprising we covered quite the range of topics today. We talked about the interventions testing program, short the ITP, and what makes it so special, what kind of mice we should use to do reasonably good aging research. We talked about rapamycin, the so-called aging rate indicators Rich is developing. We also talked about novel compounds coming from the ITP and about progeroid models. Finally, we talked about frailty, how to measure it, and the uses and abuses of frailty indices. I hope you will enjoy the podcast. I asked some intentionally rather tricky questions today. All right, it's great to see you, Rich. Thanks for coming to the podcast today.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. Recently, you're becoming a bit of a star. I saw you on the NUS Healthy Longevity webinar, on the Shiki Science Show.
Yeah, these have been good conversations. It's always nice to talk to people who are interested in aging research.
Yeah, people are getting, I think, more and more interested in that. I think it's a good time to be an aging researcher.
It's always a good time, sure.
And so today we will have basically two main themes that I want to talk about with you. One will be the interventions testing program, this big mouse testing program that you're part of, and the other one is rapamycin. How does that sound?
Sure. Talk about anything you'd like.
I mean, I have a lot of questions, but then we probably won't finish until the late afternoon, so let's maybe stick with those two for now.
All righty.
And okay, maybe I can pick up a question that Brian asked you at the NUS webinar. So you have an interest in photography, nature photography. I'm wondering, have you been to every single continent, or do you like focus on the US with your photography?
Have I been to every continent? Yeah, I guess so. You count Japan, must be part of Asia. I've been to Antarctica. Yes, I would say yes.
Do you have any favorites for like at least nature and taking pictures there?
Well, I go with a group of two Dutch photographers, Squibber. They specialize in international travel, and wherever I go with them, we have a good time. So I've been with them several times to Africa, to Botswana and to Namibia and to South Africa. And they're residents. They live in South Africa now, so they know where to go. I've also enjoyed trips with them to Hokkaido in Japan. I also have been to Scotland several times, to the Outer Hebrides and to Glencoe with a Scottish landscape photographer named Ian Cameron, who's a lot of fun to travel with too.
That all sounds pretty cool, except
A lot of fun, yeah.
maybe Africa is a bit dangerous for the photo aging, but other than that.
I try to wear sunscreen. That helps a lot.
All right, not bad. How about Austria and the Alps? Have you ever been there and done any nature photography there?
I've been to the Swiss Alps. I don't think I've been to the Austrian Alps. Yeah, there was once I was invited to give a talk at a conference on, believe it or not, kidney aging. I don't work on kidneys at all, but at least I was more at home than my other invited guest speaker, Gordon Lithgow. Gordon works on C. elegans, and C. elegans kidney research, as you can imagine, is at a rudimentary stage.
Oh yeah, a kidney conference. Wow.
It was an excuse for German kidney doctors to get a free skiing vacation. Apparently, if they go to one lecture in the morning, they can then spend the rest of the day on the slopes, and it becomes tax deductible. It's a scam, but it did get me a trip to a nice resort and a chance to hang out with Gordon for a while.
I guess that's always part of the reason why people go to conferences, to combine fun and work in a way.
Very often, yeah.
And I mean, I don't know if you've never been to Austria, there is like the Neurobiology of Aging Conference. I don't know if you've heard of this one in Bregenz.
I've never been to that conference.
Yeah, I love it. It's in Bregenz, so it's near Lake Constance. And the rumor is that people, and especially Americans, always go there because of the Oprah season. I don't know if that's true, but it's beautiful there.
I hope somebody invites me there someday. It looks sounds lovely.
We have to tell Holly Brown Borg. I think she's still organizing it, I guess.
Good idea.
Yeah. It's a lovely place, and there are always a lot of Americans there presenting mouse research. And then I noticed that somehow there's so much good mouse aging research in the US and not that much in Europe. Do you have any idea why that could be?
No, I'm not certain. You'd have to ask someone like Linda Partridge, who's worked in the United Kingdom as well as in Germany, and get an insider's view of that. I've heard from colleagues that the rules in Europe about use of animals in experimentation are extremely restrictive, and that sometimes, again, this is just from rumors, that the barriers to research using animals are so steep that people find it impossible.
Yeah, that would be my speculation as well. But it's hard wherever you go, I think, to do mouse research. In Asia, I think it's also pretty tough. I don't know about the US. You probably have a lot of ethics approvals to do as well.
You have to have a well-designed protocol, and you have to apply with appropriate rules about not causing harm unnecessarily, making sure that anything that might be harmful to the mice is justified by the science. But at least at the places where I have worked, those negotiations have not been particularly difficult. You have to be careful and thorough, but if you are that, then things work out pretty well so far.
Yeah, as long as you have a good reason for the research, and I think running the ITP study is a great reason. And well, we will get into that study in a moment. I just need to ask you kind of a question that I should ask every guest. Like, what would you say were your top three breakthroughs of the last 10 years in our field?
In aging research or in my lab? Which were you asking about?
In aging research.
Well, 10 years is not the right time horizon. The first really important breakthrough, I think, were the demonstrations by Cynthia Kenyon and Gary Rufkin and Tom Johnson and some others that single gene mutations could effectively expand worm lifespan. Most people in the field felt that it was theoretically impossible for a single genetic mutation to have an impact on aging and lifespan. Even though the calorie restriction work had been done since the 30s, people sort of pretended not to know about that. And they were wrong, and the work done in C. elegans established that definitively, while at the same time making the clear claim that it was working through increasing resistance to multiple forms of stresses. I think that was a major breakthrough. At that point, the fallback position was that, yeah, but worms are special, it won't work in mice. So the next major discovery to destroy that fallback position was the work that Holly Brown Borg and Andrzej Bartke and their colleagues published, showing that a single gene mutation in the Ames dwarf mouse would extend lifespan by 40% or more. That I think made it intellectually possible to necessary to understand that aging, though it's complicated and has lots of facets and causes lots of different kinds of harm, all of those are linked in some way, because otherwise a single gene mutation or a single diet, like the calorie restriction or the methionine restriction diet, could not delay all of those things in common. That gives us a target. We need to find out what that thing is that is linking all of the different aspects of aging and timing them in a semi-synchronized form. Once the worm work and then the Ames dwarf mouse work have been accomplished, that you could no longer honorably maintained that aging was too complicated and too multifold to be worth studying as a single entity. Those two, I think, are the major breakthroughs. The Data that the ITP produced starting, you know, in 2009 showed, in addition to that, that drugs could do it too. It's something you could put in the food. As a practical matter, changing people's genes is not going to work. And getting people to do a caloric restriction data is not going to work for sort of 99.9% of people. It's not a clinically practicable approach to intervention. But pills are practical. And the observations made by the ITP, I think most compellingly at this point, are that, yeah, you can find drugs that when you put them into the food, you slow the whole aging process down, and health span and lifespan are all increased in tandem, as one would expect. I think those are three important pillars for a future foundation of anti-aging research.
Yeah, I would totally also put the ITP and rapamycin there in like the top breakthroughs. And you make a very good point that sometimes it takes quite a long time looking back to really figure out whether something was a breakthrough, whether it really worked.
Yeah, people in the field, not just aging, but I think everywhere, have make the assumption that the things they learned in their teens and 20s must be true. After Bartke's paper came out, I was at a lecture in London being given by a guy named Robin Holiday, a very famous research scientist, renowned for contributions in aging. And he gave a long, detailed talk showing with lots and lots of math that you could never have a single gene mutation that extended the lifespan. And so I raised my hand at the end and said, you know, it's quite interesting, but as you must know, there are single gene mutations that extend the lifespan. There are these four or five that have been published in worms and at least one in the mouse. So there must be something wrong with your argument. And he said, no, 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 you misunderstand. There could never be a single gene mutation that extends the lifespan. And we did that conversational loop where he explained it could never happen, and I explained it had already happened. And eventually the topic moved to another plane. People form their opinions, and the data has sometimes not enough of an impression on what they actually believe.
Yeah, in a way, the goalposts are always shifting. Now, when people show that rapamycin works in mice, maybe there will be different arguments, like mice are not humans, mice are so short-lived, and then it continues like that.
Well, those are reasonable questions, whether things that work in short-lived animals will or will not work in longer-lived animals. Those are empirical questions. I'm a little skeptical as a matter of my personal characteristics about theoretical arguments that something will or will not happen, because they're wrong so very often. I'm more interested in data.
Even irrespectively of whether rapamycin will eventually work or not, I think the achievements of the interventions testing program are amazing. Well, maybe you can just give us a brief introduction of what you're doing in the program and what's the idea behind it.
Well, there were several different reasons why the ITP was conceived of as important, and I think turns out to be important. One is a matter of principle. If you can demonstrate conclusively that a drug can slow the aging process and postpone a wide range of age-associated changes, that finding, together with the genetic and diet findings that I mentioned earlier on, make it clear that there are processes, aging processes, which can run slower. You can do something about it. It's not a matter of radioactive decay, which is cannot be modified by any process. It's something that can be modified. That's a really important principle, independent of which drugs. A second major discovery, major implication of the ITP project is whenever we discover a new drug, it points to molecular ideas and physiological pathways that deserve further attention. We have two drugs now, acarbose and canagliflozin, which probably work by lowering the highest daily glucose level, the peak glucose level that an animal gets after it eats its main meal of the day. That's kind of cool. That was not known. It was known that would be good for if you had diabetes, but our animals do not have diabetes. So the notion that you can slow the aging process and in particular postpone lethal illnesses, including all of the cancers that kill these mice, by blunting the daily glucose peak, that's really an important finding and just tracking that down should have major implications for prevention of cancer in people. Whether or not these drugs would work to extend lifespan in people, it's an important concept. Similarly, 17-alpha estradiol, a version of the estrogen that everybody knows about, which is 17-beta estradiol. 17-alpha estradiol extends lifespan in male mice dramatically and not at all in female mice. And we don't know how. We don't know what its targets are. We don't know what cell types it's working in. After we figure out what cell type it's working in, then we can confront the issue that we don't know how that cell type is influencing the aging process. So each of these new drugs that the ITP discovers serves as a foundation for asking and hopefully beginning to answer important new questions. The third major implication is the one that you pointed to. Some of these drugs that work in mice may have actions in people. I don't think it's terrifically important whether rapamycin itself as a single chemical entity is going to have a good benefit to risk ratio in people. It may be that some other drug or some drug that affects mTOR complex 1 function in only one cell type, like a fat cell or a cell in the hypothalamus or something, can be beneficial and have a low enough safety profile. It points us to a class of enzyme targets and physiological targets and cellular targets that deserve attention from those people who would like to develop effective anti-aging medications or preventive medications. And the last thing I'll point to is that having more drugs that do slow the aging process gives you tools for asking which of their different effects are actually important in the anti-aging process. So for instance, to pick the famous example, calorie restriction affects hundreds of enzymes, hundreds of mRNAs in dozens of tissues. And it's easy to construct hypotheses about, oh, it's working on inflammation. No, it's working on obesity or fat cells or adipokines or muscles or whatever. Some of those probably are right, but most of them can't be the main story. Once you have, as we have now, four single gene mutants and at least four drugs and at least two diets, you can start to ask, how do these intersect? Are there any things that is always changed in the same direction by these genes, these diets, and these drugs? So that actually is the focus of what my lab is doing now. We've identified a dozen or so cellular and molecular characteristics that are triggered in all four of the mutants by all four drugs and by caloric restriction. We hope in this way to be sort of narrowing down our focus towards the shared mechanisms, which we believe are more likely to be worth attention than the unshared mechanisms. Each drug or each diet does its own thing. We don't care so much about those. We want to know, what does it do that's also done by the other things?
And that's a pretty smart approach to look for what these different treatments have in common. But of course, first one needed to discover all these treatments.
Right. That was the fourth point in my answer to your question. The ITP has given us four published at least, and two more that will be in our next paper, six drugs that slow aging in one sex or the other, or both. And that gives us now a set of tools to use to ask what things are held in common by many drugs and by the diets and by the single gene mutations that slow lifespan.
And based on what you said, so for future drugs, we might expect other anti-diabetic drugs to work well, or other mTOR inhibitors, I suppose.
That's a good guess. I don't know. It would be nice to find out. I mean, we're testing pioglitazone, for instance, in the current crop. Gino Cortopassi, he did a screen for a couple thousand FDA-approved drugs and over-the-counter medicines, and he did it in vitro in tissue culture cells, asking which of these agents inhibits mTOR. Gino published a paper showing that meclizine, which is an over-the-counter medication, in his in vitro tests did effectively block mTOR. It was the strongest of the drugs he found. So he asked the ITP to test it. This will be in our next paper. It does indeed lead to a small but significant lifespan increase in male mice. So Gino's idea was a good one.
And basically, anyone can ask the ITP, right, to test the compound. That's quite unique, I think.
There is an annual announcement. The deadline each year is in February. This year, it's in, I think, the last week of February. Anyone in the community, any scientist, any company, any group of scientists can suggest one or two or three or as many agents as they want to test. And then we have two different committees, a screening committee that sort of ranks them, and then a final decision committee that looks at the applications, looks at what the steering committee says, the screening committee says, and picks five or six or seven a year for initial evaluation.
Do you recall how many applications do you get? And is it more than it used to be?
No, it hasn't changed. It hasn't gone up very much. It's 10 to 15 a year. I thought it would be higher. I wish it was higher, but that's what we're getting.
That's surprising. Yeah, I would have expected it would be much higher, like 100 or something.
Yeah, the ITP application itself is very free form. You basically write down why you think the drug might be worth testing, where you think we should get it, what dose you think we should use, and whether there's any information to show that that it's not toxic in mice. And the evidence that you select, it can be in worms, it can be in mice, it can be in cell culture, whatever you think is the strongest argument that you can make. When people have a draft, they can send it to me or to David Harrison or Randy Strong or Nadia Rosenthal. We'll look at it before submission and give you feedback if you want. And the ITP website has, I think, three or four successful applications for people who want to see what arguments have worked in the past.
And then I think like four or five are usually accepted per year. Is that correct? Something like that.
Yeah, sometimes up to eight, but we average about five. The budgets that NIA approves are sufficient for us to test about five new agents a year. In a few years, we've tested much smaller numbers than that, but in most years, we pick four or five or six.
And did you have ever any problems with the budget? Is it like an ongoing project? Will you have to reapply every once in a while for
Every
funding?
award made by NIH is for a 5-year period. So it comes up for renewal every 5 years. It'll come up for renewal in the coming year. We expect to spend January, February, and March of 2023 writing like crazy in the hopes that we will have money in the program for the next 5 years, but there's no guarantee.
It must be especially tough if you want to do a longer study in some primate model. I recall, I think it was quite a big problem with the caloric restriction studies in the rhesus monkeys. So people, I think, had to reapply for funding, and it's never sure if you will get it. Is this
Yes,
correct?
it can be very frustrating. The NIH awards system is geared toward projects that last about 5 years. And so, if you have a project that really can't produce meaningful results for 10 or 15 or 20 years, you have to work within the system, which requires some tweaking and some maneuvering. It's not always easy.
Yeah, I really hope that ITP can continue for as long as possible. It's definitely one of my favorite projects in the whole field.
Well, I'm optimistic. I think it's earned a place in the community. It's, I think, widely respected, and I believe many scientists now view it as an important contributor to a wide range of Asian research. I'm hoping that our reviewers will like what we're doing. We won't make it, we will be not making very many changes at all in the next 5 years. So we'll hope to sell them on the case that what we've done for the last 20 years has worked pretty well, and we should continue to do most of it. There'll be a few minor adjustments, a few additions, but you never know what reviewers will think.
That's true. And I think what would be interesting, if you could give us a ballpark figure for the cost of running mouse lifespan studies. I think people are often surprised by how expensive this kind of research is.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to give a ballpark figure because so much of it depends upon the number of mice in your study. And the ITP wants to have 80% power to detect drugs which lead to about a 10% increase in lifespan in single sexes using two-sided tests. So when you work through the power analysis, that means that we're splitting mice across all three sites. Each site does 100 male controls each year and 50 males for each drug. So when there are three sites, that means 300 males plus 150 of each drug treatment group. And then you double that because you want to do females at the same time. So that's a lot of mice. You could, if you thought you had a drug that worked quite well and you wanted to be able to detect a 20% increase in lifespan and 10% you were willing to miss most of the time, you could get away with far fewer mice. But you'd have a lot of false negatives, a lot of things that actually do work, and you would not produce strong data for them. So the ITP study is quite expensive. And the idea of replicating things at three sites is also an expensive maneuver, but we think if a drug works at all three sites, that will lead to correct interpretation that it is more robust than if it worked at one site only.
Given the amount of mice, it's basically secretly three studies in one, so it's not a surprise that it's so expensive.
Yeah.
But I think it pays off to have three sites, and maybe we'll get to talk about this later, but for now, I have some maybe controversial questions that could be more fun than talking about just the basics of the ITP. So when looking at the compounds that you accepted for the ITP, there are a lot of interesting candidates, but I noticed quite a big bias towards like approved pharmaceutical drugs, but many of them will like never have been designed with like aging research in mind. Do you think that's a problem?
I don't understand your question. I'm sorry. What are you asking?
Right, so the ITP tests a lot of approved drugs like statins and blood pressure medications. But these don't necessarily target aging pathways. Like they were never designed to slow aging. So I don't know what kind of hope we can have for them to actually work.
Yeah, the rationale for selecting and suggesting a drug varies a great deal from person to person and from drug to drug. And the ITP tries to have a very open-minded approach to these things. Some people thought for a while that sirtuins, they were the magic thing. And they said, you must test resveratrol. It didn't work, but we did test it. Others say, nope, it's not that. It's the stuff, the good stuff that's in chocolate or in green tea. Test this. Okay, we tested that. Some people say, Nrf2, that's the stress resistance drug. Please test my drug, which activates Nrf2. All of these are plausible rationales. We're willing to accept almost any rationale, even rationales I think are extremely unlikely to work. The current vogue is for alleged senolytic drugs that allegedly remove so-called senescent cells. I think that's doomed to failure, but nonetheless, we accepted two proposals for senolytic drugs. They didn't work, but the grounds for proposing a drug can be very wide. Some of them are produced by people who say, this is the secret to aging, so this drug is going to work. And others are saying that, I think this drug has worked on cancer. Mice die of cancer. Maybe this will be good for them. Any of these suggestions are, at our current state of knowledge, plausible. Since no one really knows what times the rate of aging, anyone who says, I am certain my drug will slow aging are making it up. They don't know. But someone who says, you know, I have an intuition, a hunch that this might work on some basic mechanism. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's true. And some of the approved drugs you tested, maybe no one would have expected for them to work. Like I'm sure Acarbose wasn't a surprise to many people that it worked, whereas metformin perhaps did not perform as well.
Well, the rationale for why a drug is suggested need not be the same as for why a drug works. Give two examples. One of them is Acarbose. The people who suggested this originally said they think aging is a caloric restriction has to do with low glucose. So we'll give you Acarbose, you'll get low glucose. It'll be the same as caloric restriction. Now, they were wrong about that. There are lots of things that Acarbose does that caloric restriction does not do and vice versa. But nonetheless, Acarbose works, and it pointed us to some interesting new ideas. Another similar disjunction between the rationale and the actual story came from Jim Simpkins. He said, test out 17 alpha estradiol. Women live longer than men, and in most mouse stocks, females live longer than males. So all you really need to do is give an estrogen to male mice, and the males will live longer. They'll live just as long as females. Now, Jim was wrong about that. If you give 17-alpha estradiol to males, they live a lot longer than females. It doesn't just bring them up to the longevity of females. It brings them well past that. It's one of, it's as good, more or less as good as rapamycin for male mice. So the idea that it was simply restoring a standard female endocrine status turns out not to be correct. But nonetheless, we discovered a drug that, through an unknown target and an unknown mechanism, seems to be have a very strong male-specific longevity effect.
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting surprises in the ITP, yeah. And interesting failures as well that teach us something.
Yeah.
But so regarding the choice of compounds, I have another question. So I'm wondering about a certain omission. You tested rapamycin, but you never tested any Rapalox or any other mTOR inhibitors. Was it because they were not proposed, or was it because people voted against it?
No one has proposed them. The exception, as I mentioned to you earlier, was meclizine. It's not chemically similar to rapamycin, but it emerged from a screen for mTOR inhibitors as a potent mTOR inhibitor. And since it's an over-the-counter drug, there's an extensive human safety record, so that recommended it as well as something that was worth testing.
Yeah, having a safety record is definitely an advantage. It makes it easier to go to market with a drug.
Well, it's not a matter of going to market. Meclizine is, of course, patented and it's available at low price. is used for helping to ward off seasickness and other varieties of vertigo. So the fact that it is available to so many people and has been used for decades by many people is certainly a good reason to test drugs that you know are safe. Drugs that might or might not be safe, they could be important too, but drugs that you know are safe get a few extra points in trying to give priorities as to what to test next.
But the ITP would also theoretically test compounds which are at preclinical stage.
Yeah, we often, a small startup company will say, please test our drug for us. That was, if the rationale is good, we'll say sure.
Yeah, and if it works, it will be, of course, great publicity for the company.
Yeah. Many companies do not want the ITP to test their drugs. They're already in human clinical trials for initially narrowly targeted indications, and they don't want to know whether it would extend lifespan in mouse. They're terrified that it might have a harmful effect. So they would rather not know, and they would rather we not test it.
But so far, I think most drugs surprisingly did not turn out to be toxic that you tested. Or was this more like expected?
Yes, the next paper will have our first ever examples of two drugs that actually shorten lifespan.
Mice got unlucky in this case. But so something else about the ITP that I find really interesting is your choice of mouse model. Everyone, almost everyone uses BLEX6 mice in the field, which are like a standard model, but you choose the UM-HAT3. Why was that?
Yeah, in 1980, the National Academy of Sciences put together a blue ribbon panel, 10 absolutely first-rate experienced research scientists. And the title of their book is called Mammalian Models for Aging. In their chapter on inbred mice, they very clearly state, and I think correctly, inbred mice are an inappropriate model for most kinds of aging research. And the reason they point out that inbred mice are a bad model is A, they're homozygous, which means that they will be sick and die younger than animals that are heterozygous. So you get sickly little mice. In addition, that means they have limited heterogeneity in what they die of. Most inbred strains will only die of one thing or at most two things. And so you're not really testing a wide range of age-associated outcomes. You're testing whether the drug or gene or intervention has an impact on the specific thing that those mice die of. And then, worst of all, they are not representative of mice. That is, if you know that something works or fails to work in BLEX6, you really don't have a clue as to whether it will work or fail to work in other strains of mice. In 2016, in Neuron, Sittig and Palmer published a beautiful paper, which I refer your listeners to. They had a mutant gene that caused a specific psychiatric alteration in BLEX6 mice. And they said, hey, I wonder if it would work in other kinds of mice. So they made 30 different F1 hybrids. BLEX6 times A, BLEX6 times B, BLEX6 times C, et cetera, 30 of those. And then they crossed in this mutant gene. And about a third of the time, it had the same effect as it had in BLEX6. About a third of the time, it had no effect whatsoever. And about a third of the time, it had a significant effect, but in the opposite direction. They then tried a different mutant gene, one that has an alteration in glucose homeostasis. And it worked in BLK6 and about one third of the F1 hybrids. And in about one third, it failed to work. And in some of the other strains, it had an effect, but it was in the opposite direction. So whatever effect you got for these genetic mutants in BLK6 mice really is a poor representation, a useless representation of whether it would work on another background. So I understand a lot of people use BLK6 mice, and they do so because their mentor used BLK6 mice, and their mentor used BLK6 mice because her mentor used BLK6 mice, and so on and so forth. But it's a really rotten idea, and the best thing to do for almost all forms of research is to use genetically heterogeneous strains of mice. The mice we use in the ITP, which are catching on. I mean, after 20 years, the Jackson Lab has figured this out, and they're now starting to sell these, is a four-way cross. That is, every mouse in our colony has the same four grandparents, BLK6, BALB, C3H, and DBA2. And they're crossed in such a way that the population we get each and every year, every mouse is unique. No two mice are ever the same, but the population characteristics are always the same. That is, and any mouse has a 50-50 chance of getting the gene from the mom and a 50-50 chance of getting an allele from the father. So they share half of their genes, just like you would share half of your genes with a brother or sister. This way, we or any lab in the world can recreate this four-way cross population. We call them UMHET3 because it was the third variety of heterogeneous mice that we tried at the University of Michigan. UMHET3 mice, we have used them now for, in my lab, 25 years, and in the ITP for 20 years. So we have, for instance, over 1,000 reported cases of what did they die of pathology. And we have weight data on thousands of mice. Lovely paper from Johan Auerks and Maroon Boussleyman and Rob Williams and their colleagues just appeared, mapping genes that regulate longevity using 6,000 tails from UMHET3 mice. Since we know the age of death for, at this point, about 27,000 mice, they were able to get a subset of those mice and look at segregating loci in those animals. So it's a very powerful model. And the only reason for using BLK6 mice at this stage is a lack of careful thought.
Yeah, and it remains a big issue in the field. Many people use BLK6 mice, and then usually often it's males only. So that makes it even worse, of course.
Yeah, that's a separate issue. The a lot of people do it thing carries very little weight if you want to be a good scientist. About 50 or 60% of Americans are quite confident that when they're dead, they will go to heaven. And about an equal number are quite confident that God made people without any use of evolutionary processes about 8,000 years ago. The fact that a lot of people believe something like BLK6 is the right kind of mouse does not make it true.
Indeed. Truth is not decided by popular vote. So, okay, BLK6 maybe isn't the best model. It's also not the most horrible one. I'm just wondering, are there other good models except UMHET3? I was wondering, for example, if you have an F1 cross, like you cross a BLK6 mouse with another one, they also tend to be very long-lived. Why did you not ever choose these kinds of mice?
Ask the question again. I don't quite follow. What are you proposing as a different model?
Some F1 cross, including BLK6 or some other healthy mice.
Right. F1 animals. See, I'm going to distinguish two things, F1 mice and an F1 cross. F1 mice, where, for instance, one parent is strain BLK6 and one parent is another strain like BALB-C, they are also isogenic. That is, every single mouse in that cross has the same exact genotype. There's no segregation, no genetic variance whatsoever. Genetic variance amongst those mice is zero. They all have exactly the same genotype. And so you're going to have, if you have a drug that only works in that F1 strain, you're going to make a fool of yourself. And if you have a drug that works most of the time, but not in that F1 strain, you're going to make a fool of yourself. Now, I wouldn't recommend any isogenic mouse that is F1 hybrid or an inbred. Now, one can make an F2 hybrid. You can take an F1 mouse and cross it to an F1 mouse of the same stock. That's called an F2 hybrid. They have limited heterogeneity. There are only two parents involved, but it's certainly better than any inbred or isogenic F1 hybrid strain, because now the mice are all different from one another. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. The four-way cross mice that we use are just as easy to make, however, and they have, instead of only two inbred genotypes that are segregating, they have four. So they have somewhat greater degrees of genetic heterogeneity. And since one only has four grandparents, no more and no less, the mice that we're using are the simplest to make, with segregating alleles at each locus, and anyone can make them at any time in arbitrary numbers, decade after decade after decade. So they are stable in the sense that you can recreate the population characteristics anytime you want.
So basically, researchers should focus on using genetically heterogeneous mice.
Yeah, that's a good idea. There's some experiments for which that doesn't work. If you're transplanting a skin graft or bone marrow, you don't want to have any genetic heterogeneity at all, because then you'll have graft versus host reaction or rejection of the transplanted material. So inbred mice are really necessary for that. In addition, every inbred mouse is a terrific model for some kind of sickness. Some of them go blind, some of them are deaf, some of them have a specific weird kind of cancer. And if you want to learn more about the causes of blindness and early deafness and whatever sick little thing that inbred mouse gets, that they're really good for that. Just not for studying things that we're all interested in, like, you know, aging.
Yeah, and one thing I notice about mouse studies, it's very easy to get it wrong. So even if you try your best sometimes.
Right, that's why we're having this conversation, so that fewer people will get it wrong. I agree.
Yeah. So even in the ITP, I noticed that in some of the testing sites, your mice are kind of shorter lived than others. And I think you do not know why, right?
It's very weird. Yes, you're absolutely right. We tried to work it out so that all three sites would, we hoped, get the same longevity results. That is, we buy our diet from the same supplier and it's shipped on three separate trucks at the same time. And we buy our bedding from the same supplier and we change the cages every 14 days. So we tried our best, hoping that all three sites would come out the same. And for females, that worked great. Survival curves for female controls year after year after year are almost superimposable. The variation in the median for female survival is only about 3%. All three sites come out the same, and it's year after year after year. So that's not easy, and we got that to work. Bizarrely, for the males, we did not see that result. The males at Michigan are almost always longer lived than the males at the other two sites. And we don't know why. Clearly, we're no better at taking care of mice than they are, because our female controls always come out exactly the same. It's not that we're great and they're sloppy or anything like that. They're uncontrolled variables, things we don't understand, that are leading to this set of outcomes. It's easy to make up some hypotheses, right? Mice are very keen on smells. There could be smells that are different between Texas and Michigan and Bar Harbor, Maine. We use the local tap water, and it could be that the tap water has different amounts of organic contaminants or inorganic contaminants. There could be subtle variations in humidity or sound levels that vary influenced by low frequency sounds. My own guess is that it's temperature. The temperature in each animal colony, we have little control over that. The people who own the university and run animal care at each university, they set the standards. The temperature has to be within a very narrow limit. And the temperatures in Michigan we are required to control them at around 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Whereas in the other places, in one of them, I think it's like 73 or 74. And then the other, I'd have to double check my notes, but it's a little higher than that, even 75 or 76. So my hunch is that if I had to place one bet, it would be that it's this temperature variation that in an unknown, mysterious way is influencing male survival. But I don't understand that. The other thing that's noteworthy and doesn't affect survival per se directly is body weights, the male mice and the female mice, both sexes at Michigan, are always about 10% lighter than the mice at the other two sites. This is not sex specific. Whether that has an impact on the differences in survival curves or not is plausible, but it's a matter for speculation.
It definitely shows that it pays off to have multiple sites for replication.
Yeah, if a drug is working at all three sites, then it's more likely to be robust and do work at your site. You know, it's not that it necessarily has to be significant at all three sites, because for a drug that has a huge effect, 20%, 25% effect, it's likely to be significant at all three sites. For a drug that has a smaller effect, 8% or 10% or 12%, when you have one site only, you have one third the number of mice, and your statistical power drops really quite a lot. So it is often the case, and not at all surprising, that a drug that produces a 10% or 12% benefit in the pooled data set might not be significant at all three sites.
That makes sense. Yeah, it can be, of course, a false negative if you have a relatively small sample size.
Yeah. I mean, people say, oh, I don't believe it because it only worked at two of the three sites. They don't understand. They don't understand that if you cut your sample size by a factor of three, your statistical power for detecting a real effect goes down dramatically.
Of course, there are many papers out there showing like 4 or 5% lifespan extension in some mice. And I think the ITP kind of reveals a bit of a problem with the mouse literature. Would you say that we have an issue with quality standards for mouse research?
I don't, what do you mean? What specific problems are you thinking about?
Many studies, mouse studies are badly designed using either unhealthy controls or overweight mice, and compared to the ITP that they're badly designed. Would you agree with that?
Well, there are lots of people who make conclusions that I think are unjustified. People have very short-lived mice that are dying because they lack an important protein for development. People call these rapid aging or accelerated aging, and they believe and they argue that their treatment is pertinent to that. I think those are very bad arguments. The accelerated aging, so-called, which means basically they die young, need not, and in most cases has not, have much resemblance to real aging. Sometimes people say, let's accelerate their aging by putting them on an unhealthy diet, the famous coconut oil diet that was in the resveratrol paper that first gained resveratrol and international notoriety. They used a poisonous diet that had so much coconut oil in it that the mice died very young. Similarly, let's put them on a high-fat diet. That will accelerate their aging process. I don't think those are... I think that's a misinterpretation, whether it's a deliberate hyping of data or whether more likely it's an innocent misunderstanding or an innocent misinterpretation. I think it's really important for the field to see these things as not necessarily and not even plausibly models of what's really going on in normal aging under standard animal care conditions. And as we've just been talking, very often people do it in a single strain of mice, or even worse, a single inbred strain of mice, or a single sex, and all of those are serious design flaws. When I'm asked to review a paper which has survival data as one of its major outcomes, one of the first things I do, of course, is to look at the lifespan of the control mice. There is naturally some variation from lab to lab to lab. Even in, you know, if you look at 10 different labs working with BLAC6, the median survival for some of the mice might be 28 months or 26 months or 24 months or even 22 months. But if they're working with a strain of mice where median survival is quite low, then you have to be quite cautious that you don't want to overinterpret a survival benefit from some intervention.
So that means you're probably not a fan of all these accelerated aging models like progeroid mice.
Yeah, I think they are uninformative. If you're interested in aging, if you're interested in control of radiation damage, or some early life developmental syndrome, sure, you can learn a lot. But to build them as models of aging, things that are going to teach us about aging, I think is deceptive. Whether it's self-deceptive or deliberate overinterpretation, it's hard to guess. I can't see into the souls of other scientists, but I think it's very poorly argued. I've written an articles about this and explaining why I think these early rapid aging models are, well, to be polite, very limited value. One of my favorite examples of this was a paper published by Fabrice et al. In Nature. It was one of the very first papers in Nature. It was a cover article, six pages, something like that, in Nature. They had a model of accelerated aging. They had a single gene mutation, and it led to death of the mice in 3 months, and their controls did much better. The controls lived 6 months. And they proved that this was due to growth hormone. They could inject growth hormone into their mutant mice and move their lifespan all the way up to normal, that is 6 months of age. A Nature article, and they listed in the article 10 characteristics of aging that their fast aging mouse had a lot of. So the punchline is that their fast aging mouse turned out to be the Ames dwarf mouse. And as you know, the Ames dwarf mouse is actually, put it into a nice clean colony, lives 40% longer than controls. It's not a model for slow, for fast aging. It's actually a model for slow aging. Their colony was so unhealthy that even their controls were dead at 6 months of age. And these poor little Ames dwarf mice, which have rather bad immunity, they were knocked off by something, presumably infection, within 3 months. The other thing that I emphasize to students when I teach this paper is not just that you need to be very cautious about claims that an animal is showing accelerated aging. They had a list of 10 things that their mice showed accelerated aging at. 9 of those 10 do not occur in old mice. So the reviewers, as well as the authors, bought it. You know, they said, oh, yeah, look, here's a nice list of 10 things that occur with aging. And nobody actually asked the obvious question, do any of these actually occur with aging? The answer was no, they don't. So it's a nice instructive paper in many ways. And it's not the only one.
That's a pretty cool story about Ames mice. I've never heard it before.
Yeah, look it up. Fabrice et al. Nature. I'll send you the reference. Send me an email and I'll be glad to send you the reference.
But overall, I mean, the argument about the fast aging, the progeroid mice, makes sense, because to make them age faster, you would have to know what aging is. But we're kind of still trying to figure it out. So maybe it's not the best strategy.
I think there are good practical. I've issued a challenge, and here, right here in public, I will issue a challenge to anyone who thinks they have a good fast aging mouse called the Mr. Speedy Mouse Competition. Write down, before you look at your mouse, 10 things that are characteristic of aging. And they need to be 10 things in different systems. So they might be, for instance, poor vaccine responses to influenza, and a loss of muscle mass and a switch in fiber types, and a loss of ability to perceive high-pitched noises. Write down 10 different things in 10 different systems before you look at your mouse that you think are part of aging. And then prove to me that your mouse gets, I'll consider you a winner if you get seven of those 10 things. But that's not how these people work. What they do is they find a list of things their mouse has, and then they try to sell it as things that aging mice also have. They often make a rather bad case of that, but you see, it's the opposite argument. I would be willing to accept a slow, or at least to consider seriously, a fast aging mouse if they let me make a list of 10 things that, or they could make a list of 10 things that happened in old mice, and they could show that the 70% of them also occur rapidly in their mouse. No one has taken up the challenge. $25 American dollars I'm willing to offer to anyone who passes this challenge.
That's an offer that is hard to refuse.
Yeah.
But let's say, what about people who don't have time for a mouse study? Like, which model would you recommend to them? They should not choose a fast aging progeroid mouse. So what else?
I think the question is poorly conceived. There is no substitute at present for testing whether a drug, for instance, would slow aging in mice, except by giving it to mice and watching them age and seeing if they're aging slowly. There's no shortcut. There's no validated secret set of things you can measure. My lab, as I mentioned to you, is trying to get there. We now have a list of a dozen or so cellular changes and physiological changes and molecular changes that we have noticed are triggered early in life in young adult mice by all of the ITP drugs and all of the mutants we have available to us and the calorie-restricted diet. So we have a hypothesis. We don't have proof yet. We have a hypothesis that any drug that will trigger all of those is going to work for aging. And we're going to try to do some experiments, and we can get funding for this, where we're going to take some regular old mice, put them on a series of 30 different drugs that have not yet been tested for aging, and see if we get triggering of these 10 different, what we call them, aging rate indicators. And if in, you know, a month or 2 months or 4 months, these aging rate indicators all light up for this drug, for drug 11, we will make a guess that drug 11 may be an authentic anti-aging drug. But now we'll need to check that out. We'll need to give drug 11 to some mice and see if it slows the aging process. But we hope that triggering this battery of putative aging rate indicators may give us a way to narrow our focus to drugs that have a better chance of working. And of course, it also gives us, if it's true, hints as to what is upstream of all of those markers. What is it that all of these drugs and genes and diets are doing in common that changes UCP1 in the fat, M1 macrophages, M2 macrophages, FNDC5 in muscle, double cortin and BDNF in the brain, GPLD1 in the liver, irisin in the plasma, et cetera, et cetera. They all change together, and that's not a coincidence, but what it is that's causing them to change together is sort of, in a crude sense, the holy grail, the thing we'd really like to know. But at present, there is no suitably vetted model that will allow you to determine whether a drug has an anti-aging effect in mice other than patiently waiting in mice.
Right. It would be amazing to predict it from other evidence or some biomarkers.
Yeah, the thing to note is that it's not biomarkers. Biomarkers are things that change with age. And so if you believe that your drug is slowing aging, you want to wait till the mice are old and then measure the biomarker. So in normal mouse, the biomarker will have gone up a lot. And in the treated mice, if your drug works, the biomarker will have gone up only a little. It's what we're looking at here is quite different. These are aging rate indicators. And it doesn't matter what age you're looking at. You can look at young mice. And if they're up, then you can guess, you can assume, if we can prove it, that these mice are going to be aging slowly. The analogy that I use is the difference between an odometer and a speedometer. In your car, the odometer tells you how old the car is, how many miles it has already been driven. And you can't tell when you have had the car for a few weeks whether it's going to be aging slowly or quickly, whether it's driving slowly or quickly. What these aging rate indicators are, we hope, speedometers. They tell you how rapidly the car is moving at any one time or how rapidly the aging process is happening in your young adult or middle-aged adults. You can't tell how old an animal is by looking at an aging rate indicator. For that, you need biomarkers. And you can't tell how quickly it's aging by looking at biomarkers. For that, you need aging rate indicators.
Right, so the aging rate indicators lead to a change in biomarkers downstream eventually.
Yeah, that's right. If you have two mice that differ in their aging rate indicators, like one is calorie restricted and one is not, plausible guess is that when they get old, the biomarkers of aging will have changed a lot in the controls and only a little tiny bit in the calorie restricted mice. So yeah, that's the link between them. They're both related to aging, but one of them is related because it changes with aging, and the other is related because it tells you whether the animal is aging quickly or slowly. Those are different relationships.
And several of the drugs that the ITP discovered change these aging rate indicators, like rapamycin, for example.
All of them do. That's what's so exciting. Rapamycin does, acarbose does, 17-alpha-estradiol does, and acarbose, canagliflozin, and 17-alpha-estradiol. For some of them, interestingly, the male-specific lifespan drugs, that is, 17-alpha-estradiol and canagliflozin, change the aging rate indicator only in the male mice. So that's kind of nice. They also change in Ames dwarf, Snell dwarf, growth hormone receptor knockout mice, and Pepe knockout mice. And they also changed it and caloric restricted mice. So all 9 months.
I'm curious, how optimistic are you about rapamycin that it might eventually help human aging?
I don't have any idea. I mean, long-term rapamycin is bound to have side effects. No one's been on rapamycin as a human being for 30 or 40 or 50 years, and it's certainly going to have some risks. In some patients, it causes a loss of some kinds of immunity while it boosts other kinds of immunity. In some people, it causes ulcers. In our mice, it causes cataracts. In our mice, it causes testicular failure. So it's going to have some side effects. And anyone who might, God forbid, be thinking of taking rapamycin themselves for the next 30 or 40 years needs to think really carefully about what potential side effects of an unknown drug might be and the unknown benefits, how that's going to balance. That being said, it may well be possible to find more sophisticated modes to TOR inhibition. It might be, for instance, that what rapamycin is really doing is changing properties of a specific kind of fat cell or a specific kind of macrophage or a specific switch in the inflammatory pathways in the hypothalamus. If that's how it's really working to slow the aging process, then designing a drug that addresses that hypothalamic target or that macrophage target or whatever could give you a drug that has all the benefits and far fewer side effects. That would be worth knowing about. So it's a long process between the sort of initial hit. You know, if you're a drug company and you'd like to make a drug that helps people control their blood pressure, the first time you get a drug that helps a rat control its blood pressure, a hypertensive rat, you view that as a major step forward, but you don't say, okay, now let's give it to people. Because the refinement, the trying of other families, other compounds affecting the same target, which have different side effects that are more or less potent, that's a well-trodden path. Companies do it when they think they're going to get a drug that's going to have commercial potential and major potential in health. It's well worth doing, but you don't simply say, hey, see, this works in mice. Now I'm going to take it. Or at least you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, there are probably several steps before humans should start taking this. So, for example, people are aiming to test rapamycin in dogs first to see whether it extends the lifespan of this animal. That's probably one good thing to test.
Yeah, I think if they found evidence that dogs lived longer on rapamycin, that would be good news. I think the people who are doing that study have made some mistakes, unfortunately. This is Matt Kaeberlein mostly, but also Dan Promistel. The original idea was to give the dogs the rapamycin for many years. It's a 5-year study. They were hoping that if you start with 5-year-old dogs, by 10 years of age, many of the dogs may have died, and that might give you enough statistical power if rapamycin really was slowing the aging process. But they're very concerned, as they should be. They don't want to hurt the dogs at all. It would be really a bad thing, both in terms of science, their relationship with the pet owners. It would be a bad idea to hurt the dogs. And so now they've decided they're going to give the dogs rapamycin for just 1 year. And I'll bet that's safer. But it's far less likely, I think, to have a benefit. So they're putting an awful lot of time and money and dogs through this process. If you do that, you want to have a design that's optimized to get you a result. And I suspect, and of course, no one really knows. They don't have the data. When they have the data, we'll all know. But you can see the rationale for thinking that a 1-year exposure may not be as good as continuous exposure. I tried to convince them they should instead use a drug like Acarbose, which has a long safety record in people and doesn't have the same spectrum of side effects as rapamycin, but it's their experiment, and they decided instead they wanted to try rapamycin. So we'll see how it comes out. Maybe against my intuition, they'll have a nice positive outcome. That'll be really an important finding.
I mean, we still don't know a lot about rapamycin. We're still not sure about the mechanism of action, as you alluded to, whether it's like mTORC1 inhibition or mTORC2 activation or on which cells it acts, right?
Yeah, I mean, presumably the principal target is mTOR complex 1, but We don't know what cell types are important in its anti-aging effect. And mTOR complex 1 has many, many downstream pathways that it contributes. Just looking at the first step, it has some effects on phosphorylation of S6 and other on phosphorylation of 4-EBP1. And they turn out to be very, very different. There's an age-associated increase in the ratio of phospho-S6 to S6 because there's an age-associated change in phosphorylation of the S6 protein. However, the change with phosphorylation of 4-EBP1 is not due to a change in the actual number of phosphoprotein molecules. It is because there's a major change in the total protein level of 4-EBP1. So even at that first level of looking at the two most famous mTOR complex 1 phosphoprotein substrates, the whole system gets to be very complex, and that's even before you feed in all of the feedback circuits and compensatory loops. We did a nice study years ago. We looked at mRNA for 9 different genes in mice that had been treated with rapamycin. We found that there three of the genes, rapamycin made that gene mRNA level go down, and it stayed down forever. Great. 3 more, it went down, and then it came back up halfway through the lifespan. So there was some compensatory mechanism that counterbalanced and then overcame the rapamycin effect. And then 3 more, it had a slow effect, which got worse and worse and worse and worse. It was a gradual effect as the mouse got older. So even at such a simple level as, is this mRNA changing with age, we saw 3 entirely different patterns with rapamycin, and presumably we would have seen even more complexity if we had looked at a larger range of genes. It's not simple.
That's true. All the best to Matt Kevalainen and the dogs. I'm wondering about the treatment duration. You said 1 year for dogs. That would be similar to like 10% of a mouse lifespan. Did anyone ever try this in mice to see whether that could even work?
Well, I don't think it's easy to translate what percentage of a lifespan. So I'll skip that part of the question. But we did publish a paper last year in which we tried 3 different rapamycin dosing schedules in the mice. 1 dosing schedule, we started rapamycin at 20 months and we left it on until they died. So that's continuous. That worked great in males and females. Then for the next group, we added rapamycin at 20 months of age. We took it off at 23 months of age. They never saw it again. So that was a 3-month pulse of rapamycin. That worked great in the male mice and didn't work in the females at all. And then the third dosage schedule, we start at the same age, 20 months. We give it 1 month on, 1 month off, 1 month on, 1 month off, over and over and over again, 1 month cycles till they died. That worked great in male mice, just as good as continuous. In the females, it had a significant effect. It was beneficial, but not as good as the continuous dose curve. So in our case, it was sex specific. It's a little complicated to interpret that in mice because, at least in young adults, if you give them the same amount of rapamycin in the chow, the blood levels are higher in females and lower in males. So we didn't measure the blood levels in the mice that were in the, you know, the monthly on-off schedule or the after you turned rapamycin off, how long it stayed up. We didn't know any of it.
Right. And because of the blood levels, it normally works a bit better in females.
Yes. I mean, the observation is that at a given chow dose, the extension of lifespan is higher in females every time we've done it. And I suspect that's because the blood levels are higher. There's data that the blood levels are higher. What we don't know is whether the sex difference in lifespan is because the blood levels are higher. That's a perfectly plausible guess, but we haven't proven it. The way to do it would be to define rapamycin doses in chow that give the same blood levels in the males and female, and then check out their lifespan. I think that's worth doing, but it's not something we've tackled yet.
That would be a very interesting experiment. I was wondering if I can get your opinion about rapamycin. So some people have argued that it postpones aging rather than slowing aging. Do you have any strong opinions on that matter?
Almost all aspects of aging occur more slowly in rapamycin-treated mice. And so the data are very strong that it is slowing the aging process. And it is also extending lifespan, which is exactly what you would expect if it was slowing the aging process. Now, in our studies, I mentioned these aging rate indicators. It changes those pretty quickly. So it has some acute immediate effects, and some of those are in directions that you would expect would accompany healthy lifespan. For instance, UCP1, the uncoupling protein 1 in mitochondria. Others have shown that if you have a transgenic mouse with a lot of UCP1, they live a long time. So high UCP1 is good for you. Anything that turns on UCP1 in fat tissue, for instance, would be expected to be good for you. So drugs can have acute short-term effects that lead to variation in health maintenance activities. That may be how some of these anti-aging drugs work. But the idea that they slow aging is based now on an extremely solid foundation. As the mice get older, the bad things that happen to old mice happen more slowly in the rapamycin-treated mice than they do in the controls.
Right. So the fact that the mice are healthier and that it extends the median lifespan is pretty good evidence that it slows aging in your eyes.
It extends the median lifespan. It also extends the maximum lifespan. And the strongest evidence would be to look at a lot of different, as we've done, of course, a lot of different age-sensitive parameters to see if they are also slowed. For instance, we published a cross-sectional pathology study. We looked at 11 different tissues and organs in our rapamycin-treated mice. The pathologist looked at 10 of these, and a colleague of mine, Sue Brooks, who can look at tendon stretchiness, looked at the tendons. Of those 11 different outcomes, 10 showed slower aging in the rapamycin-treated mice. Only one showed the same amount of aging in the rapamycin-treated mice. And in 5 of those cases, the amount was statistically significant, even though we only had 20 mice per group. So those are pathological changes that occur in middle age. They don't lead to the death of the mouse, but they are signs that aging is modifying and harming tissue function. In addition, others have studied things like grip strength and cognitive function and rotor rod function and a batch of other health indicators, which get worse as mice get older. And by and large, there are a few exceptions. Rapamycin delays those changes as well. So we have good evidence that it is slowing all sorts of bad things that happen to you as you get old. That plus the median health lifespan data plus the maximum lifespan data make a nice consistent case.
Right. And do we have similar data for acarbose already?
Well, acarbose extends median and maximum lifespan. It improves grip strength and rotor rod. I think we've done the cross-sectional pathology study and found, you know, delay in those things as well. But rapamycin had a bigger effect, and so it has a bigger effect on pathology. The latest study in the pathology area comes from canagliflozin. That was just published last year, or this year, actually. The pathologist, Jessica Snyder, and her colleague, Warren Ladigas, looked at tissues. We're really interested to see if canagliflozin not only would slow diseases, but do it in a sex-specific way, because canagliflozin is male-specific for lifespan. What Jessica found was that 6 different lesions went up with aging in normal mice, and canagliflozin blocked 5 of them, well, blocked 6 of them in the males, and only 1 was also blocked in the females. 5 of the 6 were blocked in a male-specific way. So that's quite consistent that whatever mechanism, whatever unknown mechanism is leading to slow aging and lifespan extension in the males treated with canagliflozin is also delaying at least these 6 diseases in the canagliflozin treated mice as well.
I guess one of the concerns might be that drugs just postpone cancer, let's say, without affecting health span.
Yes, that would have been a reasonable guess until we had data that they were also slowing the aging effects on so many other outcomes. Since most mice used in experimental laboratories die of some form of cancer, they were basically chosen by cancer biologists early in the 1900s as good models for cancer. So it's not terribly surprising that many kinds of mice will die of cancer. And the head three mice, the males typically die of either blood cancer or liver cancer or lung cancer. The females don't get the lung cancer, but they get breast cancer instead. So these six kinds of cancer are the most common. Hemangiosarcoma is the other one. Most common causes of death in these mice. But a drug that merely slowed all kinds of cancer, though it might be of interest to cancer biologists, would be less interesting to me unless the drug also slowed other aspects of aging. And that's why these pathology papers are so important. And the papers on age-sensitive functional decline in things like grip and cognition and hearing and that sort of thing. If you've shown that your drug not only extends median and maximum lifespan, but also slows the rate of change in a lot of different health-related physiological indicators, I think you're have a strong case to make that it is slowing the aging process.
Yeah, I agree. It's important to measure both lifespan and healthspan in these animals to make that case.
I have been very, very careful never to use the word healthspan. I talked about age-sensitive, health-related outcomes. Healthspan implies a number, and you really cannot measure a healthspan. You can measure, however, the level of change in an age-sensitive outcome, and that includes a lot of health outcomes that are related to how healthy a person or a mouse might be. But there is no such thing as health span.
So you're not a big fan of that word.
A terrible idea. I mean, consider my Uncle Bob. When Bob was 55, slipped and he broke his hip. He never walked without a limp again. When he was 60, he got diabetes and he had some problems with his vision. When he was 70, he began to lose cognition. He had to give up his job because he could no longer run his store. But he could still, you know, have a conversation and enjoy life and watch baseball games. When he was 80, he was blind and deaf. You could have a conversation with him if you spoke real loud. There was something in there. So what was his health span again? If you define health span the casual kind of fuzzy way that most people do, they sort of wave their hands, oh, the amount of time before your health is impaired. Was it when he broke his hip and he could no longer play soccer? Or was it when he began to lose his sight or when he needed insulin shots? Or what date over that 40-year span, that would you assign what number to his health span? Since the answer is no one can do it, health span doesn't measure something. It makes it appear as though you're a sophisticated person. But it also means that you haven't been developing an operational definition. The reason it's come into our community as a conversation is the really odd idea that health span and lifespan are on a seesaw. You can have one or the other. People, particularly at the Aging Institute, have been fond for decades of saying, we want to add life to years. And that's a wink and a nod and a coy way of saying, we don't want to make you live longer. We're not interested in lifespan. We are interested in health span. We want you to be healthy as long as possible. And that makes you think that you can either focus on health span or on lifespan. It's a trade-off. But that's contrary both to common sense and to all the evidence. All of the drugs and all of these genetic mutants, they increase both together. And of course they do. The reason these animals live longer is that they stay healthy for longer. I guess it's theoretically possible you could invent a drug that would increase lifespan without health span. Maybe hypothetically, you could have a drug that took sick little mice and somehow just stopped them from dying. I don't know how that would work. I don't know of any evidence that such a thing can happen. But all of the evidence we have now is of the authentic anti-aging drugs that the ITP has found and that others have begun to find as well are working on lifespan because all sorts of health-related things, health span sorts of things are being slowed at the same time. They're linked together as indeed it should be. That makes common sense.
Yeah, if aging causes age-related diseases, then it should have an impact on health and lifespan together, of course.
Yes.
But regarding measurements of health, I have one last question. What's your opinion about the frailty index in mice?
I think it's misunderstood and, as currently implicated, highly problematic. And the problem is that the word frail has in a colloquial use and a reasonably well-defined clinical meaning, operational definition. And the people who are using frailty index in mice are not paying attention either to the typical colloquial use of the word or to the fairly well-validated human clinical syndrome called frailty and its measurement through the human frailty index that Linda Fried and her collaborators have spent so many productive years working out. Colloquial use, you say someone is frail if he or she is really looks kind of sick, can't get out of the wheelchair anymore, has lost her appetite. That's what frail means. They need help getting in and out of cars. So Linda Fried and her colleagues spent many years working on an operational definition that could be incorporated into geriatrics research protocols. They defined five things like weight loss and loss of strength that you could look at quickly in a human patient and state that they are frail or not frail and use that for human geriatrics research protocols. There's some problems. Many of their people, they never get all five. They sometimes get four or three. And so in clinical use, this is called partly frail or slightly frail or semi-frail, but they're aware of these defects. Now, the people who would like to do the same thing for mice haven't learned from those experiences. Basically, they have made a list of about 30 things that are sometimes seen as mice get older, and you get 1 point for each of them. And they say, see, look, you can tell these mice are getting frail more quickly because the number of points they get goes up as the mouse gets older. So what's wrong with that? The first thing that's wrong with it, it has nothing to do with frailty as it's used either in the colloquial or clinical sense. These are mice that are walking around, able to get their food, able to have social interactions with other mice. And also they're not going to die right away. So they're not frail in either of those, in any of those senses. Another point is that they haven't optimized their index. There are well-validated ways, if you have a 30-point scale, of assigning, calculating weights for each element in the scale. Many of those items on the scale are very tightly correlated with one another. And so you don't want to give them each 1 point. You want to adjust them. You want to weight them so that you get the maximum amount of information. This is called factor analysis, and it's close relative principal component analysis, in which some elements of the scale get zero weight and some get 1/10 of the amount of weight of an average variable, whereas some might get the amount of weight of three or four variables put together. The people who are developing frailty indices for mice so far, at least judging by the papers I've been asked to review, they don't want to take that trouble. They give everybody a score of one. It makes no sense. It's unjustified. It's clearly statistically invalid, but it's really easy to do the calculation. 1 point for every point on your checklist. And then using this frailty index, some of the papers are hilarious. They show in the same group of mice, the mice get frailer and frailer and frailer, and then they get less frail and less frail and less frail for several months, and then they get frail again. This is prima facie evidence that whatever you're measuring, it doesn't meet the sort of criteria that you would expect a frailty index to meet. And it's hard to give good credit to people who don't notice that the index they're using has failed its sort of first line test. There was a really great poster, I thought, at the last Gordon conference on the systems of aging. Somebody who shared this degree of skepticism about frailty indexes took some data from people who've been measuring a frailty index in mice and did the sort of most obvious thing, a principal component analysis. And he found that there were two principal components that conveyed 90% of the predictive value of the so-called frailty index. That if you just measured things on the first principal component and the things on the second principal component, anything you added to that did you no good. I like that. I mean, I'd still like to see one that discriminates the mice that are in desperately poor health. That's sort of the human equivalent of frailty. So if you did get an index, a combined metric that discriminated mice that were at 70% of the medium, 80%, 90%, 100, 110% of the median, this index went up and up and up and up. I think that would be kind of cool. Calling it frailty is false advertising. It has nothing to do with frailty in the human or human clinical or colloquial sense, but it still might be a useful index of health, of age-sensitive health status, if someone took the trouble to do it.
Right. So if you think it can be rescued if people pay more attention to the statistic and actually measuring it correctly?
I think one could develop a useful index of physiological status that is age sensitive across a wide range of mice. It would have to work in 20 different F1 hybrid stocks and in genetically heterogeneous stocks. It would have to be slowed by caloric restriction and by the Snell dwarf mutation and by rapamycin and by carbos, etc. If you showed that your index was appropriately modified by anti-aging manipulations of this kind and worked across both sexes in a wide range of different stocks, that would be really cool. I wouldn't call it a frailty index. It's not, nothing to do with frailty. It has something to do with age-sensitive health status, probably. Calling it frailty is just muddying the waters, but still would be really well worth doing. I don't know that people have done that yet. I don't think they are doing it, but I'd love to see it done. Frailty is one of the bad things that can happen to you when you get old. Sometimes you get blind. Sometimes you get deaf. Sometimes you lose cognitive ability. Sometimes your skin starts to get wrinkly. Sometimes you go bald. And sometimes you get frail. It's one of a list of 40 or 50 very familiar things that happen to old people. And many of them happen to old mice. Frailty in people tends to happen in their last year or two or three of life. It's really kind of late. Most of those other things begin to happen more quickly than frailty in an average person's life history trajectory. That's what frailty has always meant colloquially and in the human geriatrics research literature. Mouse biologists are jealous and they want to make it relevant and they want to fool grant funders into saying, wow, these guys can measure frailty in mice. That is super duper cool. But they're not measuring frailty in mice. They're not even, you know, thinking very clearly about what they are measuring or how best to measure it. Whatever it is not frailty. So that's why I'm kind of down on it, yeah.
Have you experimented with your own mice, UMH3, doing frailty index on them?
I have no interest in what kills mice or whether they get frail or not. The only thing my lab cares about is what's happening in youth and in middle age that discriminates slow aging mice from normal mice. The details of whether this mouse died of cancer or this mouse had problems with hearing or this mouse. I mean, we do study some age sensitive diseases from time to time. We're obviously interested in whether our anti-aging drugs would diminish the rate of cognitive decline. That's an important biological question we need to work harder on. And we have already published papers about whether the drugs modify bone loss or modify hearing loss. We've published papers on all of those. I think those are cool topics, but there are a lot of bad things that happen to mice that are of limited interest when the lab really is focused on different things that slow aging, not so much as how aging is related to diseases of aging.
You're right, that probably those aging rate indicators would be more useful if they turn out to work than just measuring frailty or biomarkers.
Yes, they are different domains. They are different questions. Biomarkers are telling you whether the particular old mice you're looking at have had a slower rate of development of age-sensitive change. The aging rate indicators tell you instead whether the two animals of whatever age you're looking at, even young mice, are aging at different rates. Those are different questions and they have different implications.
All right. It was a very interesting conversation. We covered so many things.
Good. I'm delighted to have been invited to participate on your show.
All right. That was a great podcast. Even though Rich was sick and for me it was quite late in the night after a long day of science, I think we managed quite well. I would just like to add two small comments after the podcast. So regarding the ITP, as I said, I totally love it and I wish it was much bigger than it is. My major criticism, which I mentioned, was that the ITP is a bit biased towards approved drugs, which target age-related diseases, instead of more experimental drugs that might directly target aging per se. As gerontologists, we always say that we have to target the root cause of aging, right? And I do not think that approved drugs are doing that, certainly not statins and not most blood pressure lowering medications. On the other hand, I do understand Rich's argument that each drug proposed, even if it was a traditional drug, it was evaluated on its own merits. Nevertheless, I still think there remains a bias towards playing it safe in the ITP, and personally, I wish it was a bit more experimental. And when I say I want the ITP to be bigger, I don't just mean testing more compounds per year, although there is of course room for improvement here. If we could test many more compounds, this would be amazing. There are also other ways we should have studies that are similar to the interventions testing program. For example, a systematic effort to screen gene knockouts, transgenic mice overexpressing potential longevity genes, also programs that work with adenoviral delivery and other types of gene therapy. Because as we've recently seen, these therapies show a lot of promise, at least in mice, but most studies are small and replication is a huge issue. So I hope in the future we can get a systematic study that tries to evaluate these treatments. Finally, I think the time has come for radical exploration of combination therapies. I know the ITP has started looking at combinations, famously, for example, rapamycin and acarbose or rapamycin and metformin, but we definitely need more such research. And I know there is a lot of published and unpublished work going on in mice, so there is a lot to look forward to in this regard. As for my second point, while I do think that rapamycin is the best drug we have, in fact, I'm on the record for saying that rapamycin should be in the TAME study rather than metformin. No one can claim that I'm not a rapamycin optimist. However, there is one major question mark for me when it comes to rapamycin, and I do know that Rich and Matt Kaebelein both kind of disagree with this. And I used to think the same way as they do. If a drug extends median and maximum lifespan in healthy mice and slows age-related decline, then it slows aging. However, it seems we need to be a bit more precise and distinguish between slowing and postponing aging. In the clinic, this will not be an immediately relevant distinction, but I think in the long term, this will be very important for the field. In fact, there is mounting evidence that rapamycin is kind of strange. Different papers studying mortality patterns using Gompertz and other mathematical approaches find that RAPA behaves differently than caloric restriction and provide at least some limited evidence for postponing rather than slowing aging. In addition, the benefits of RAPA in the ITP do not scale very well with age of onset. If you look at the initial study where it was given at 600 days, lifespan extension was around 9 for males and 13% for females. Later, when rapamycin was given at 9 months of age or 270 days, the median survival extension was around 10% in males and 18% in females. So it seems like it worked marginally better when it was given much earlier. I have not really looked at the data in depth because there are many more recent rapamycin studies, but it does seem that the benefits of RAPA do not scale very well with the age of onset. And if it was slowing aging, then we would expect it to work much better when initiated early. At least that would be my personal intuition here. And most importantly, one recent paper from a German group found that looking at mice with an mTOR hypomorphic allele, so not rapamycin per se, but still a mutation in the mTOR pathway, they found that this kind of mutation leads to immediate improvements in multiple age-related parameters, but even in young mice. And this then gives kind of the illusion that rapamycin or caloric restriction or this mTOR hypomorphic allele are slowing aging, when in reality they lead to a rather quick, almost immediate improvement in, how would you call it, resilience, robustness of mice, which might be definitely related to aging. There is no doubt about that. But it seems like this is different from slowing aging if this study holds true. And it seems we are measuring age-related decline incorrectly without having a young control group. Because usually what we would do is we would measure cross-sectionally. We would have a group of mice that was fed rapamycin and one group that was fed some control diet. And when they reach a certain age, we compare the two. But usually we do not compare very, very young mice that have been given rapamycin for, say, 30 days. And maybe we should do this. Maybe we'll uncover something very interesting. So those are the two major comments and my closing remark for today. Thanks for listening.